you to the bakers. If you've not been to one of these before, I think most of you have, it is a bit different in that it's very much sort of a teaching session. And the reason I think that David suggested that we had a look at Hebrews was very much that it is quite a difficult book to understand if you've ever tried reading it. You probably will find it useful to have a Bible, so if you haven't got one and you want to grab one, there are some at the back, just because obviously I'll be flicking through bits of what's going on, hopefully. As I say, it is a bit of a mystery as a book. It's not an easy read. To me, it feels like one of those people who you start having a conversation with. They're terribly enthusiastic about something, and they start off on one track, and then they move on to something else, and then they veer back again, and then they go off again at a tangent, and you stop for a moment to try and work out what it is they're saying, and you've missed three different points that they've made, and then you have to come back. And to me, that's what the book reads like. It's very busy, it's very fast-moving, it's packed full of ideas. You could take a verse and spend ages just looking at that one. If I was marking the book as an essay, my main comment would be, get your thoughts together and put them in a better structure. Different commentators suggest different structures, and I have got a couple of sheets there that suggest very different structures. But I would suggest at the heart of this letter, which is actually much more like a sermon, is a pastor or a parent who is absolutely desperate that his readers or his children run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. And on that first screen, I've got these quotes from it. Draw near to God, don't give up, fix your eyes on Jesus. That's what the author is wanting, and he is absolutely desperate that his readers pick up on that. So my aim tonight isn't to give you a Bible study on Hebrews, sorry if that's what you thought you were coming to, but it's to set out something of what seems to be the purpose of the book, some of the influences that were on the writer, and some of the themes which he develops, which explain really why he wrote what he wrote in the way he wrote it. And I hope by the end that you will go away and read the book of Hebrews again and be excited by its amazing message of Jesus. It's just oozes with how amazing Jesus is, what he's done for us. And it will give all of us the encouragement to fix our eyes on Jesus again, even when things are hard, which is what the situation was for the people to whom he was writing. Now, a bit of background. This is the bit Paul really wants to do. Okay? Who wrote it? I suggest, if you're interested, you get hold of two or three good commentaries and read their introductions. There are lots of contenders for this. Traditionally, it's Paul. Oh, if my clicky will work. Yeah, traditionally, it's Paul. But there's also Barnabas, Luke, Apollos, Silas, and David was saying tonight, Mary. There you go. What we do know is that the author was almost certainly Jewish, which eliminates Luke. And we know this because he has an excellent knowledge of the Old Testament. That, again, is very clear if you just open the book. Also, we think that he came from the Hellenistic side of Jewish teaching, so he was a Greek. When he quotes the Old Testament, he quotes from the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation of the Hebrew. And perhaps, there's some debate about this, he uses Greek philosophy, particularly a Jewish philosopher who was very influenced by Greek thought, a bloke called Philo, who lived in Alexandria around the same time as this letter was written. We also think he probably was living somewhere in Italy, in that at the end of the letter he says, those from Italy send your greetings. And it seems to be this lack of certainty as to who wrote it, which is why it's one of the last books to be accepted as one of the scriptures in the New Testament. It wasn't accepted universally until the middle of the 4th century, although Christians used it and loved it well before this time. We also don't know when it was written. However, a bloke called Clement of Rome quotes it in a letter that he wrote around 96 AD, so it was definitely before that time. And some people say that since he doesn't mention the temple but talks about the tabernacle, it must have been written after the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. However, as we will perhaps get time to see, the references to the tabernacle are actually really important. The temple wouldn't have served his purpose, so it's not conclusive at all. But anyway, by 96 AD, this had been written. So who was it written to? We don't know. But clearly Jewish Christians, because otherwise it would have been totally incomprehensible because of all the Old Testament quotes. You have to have a good knowledge of the Old Testament to understand it. And that's why it's known as the letter to the Hebrews. What we do know about them is that they had suffered persecution previously and were probably going to face some more in the near future because of their faith. The author reminds them in chapter 10 with these words, "Remember those earlier days after you had received the light when you endured in a great conflict full of suffering. You need to persevere so that when you've done the will of God, you will receive what he's promised." And then later in the letter he says, "In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood." So there's been temptation, there's been persecution, but they haven't been killed, which is obvious since they're reading it, but there you go. We also know that they weren't new to the faith. He tells them that they should be teaching other people by this stage, not going over and over the basics of faith. So why was it written? Now that is a bit clearer, you'll be pleased to know. As I've already said, one of the great concerns of this author was that his readers didn't give up their faith in Jesus. We don't know whether this means they were tempted to go back to their Jewish roots or whether it was to give up on faith altogether. But the purpose of the writing is to stop this process by convincing them that Jesus is the only one who can enable them to draw near to God and to serve the living God. Nothing else, no one else. And so he opens his letter, which, as I say, is much more like a sermon, with words that set out very clearly, right at the beginning, his very high view of Jesus. This will give you a taste of how dense this book is in the way that it speaks. It's just amazing. "In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty in heaven." And I think we could spend a month meditating on those few verses. We will come back to them. That's his high view of Jesus. He is the exact representation of God, the radiance of God's glory. He's the creator, the sustainer. Just amazing words. And he wants to convince his readers of this. And then, having set that out right at the beginning of the letter, he spends most of the rest of the letter convincing them from the Old Testament that Jesus, the Son of God, is superior to everything else that has ever been used to enable them to draw near to God. He's superior to the angels, to Moses and the promised land, to the Old Testament Levitical priests and their sacrifices, to the Old Covenant. And he uses Old Testament characters and events to then warn them against giving up their faith, as well as to give them good examples of people of faith from the Old Testament. He says that as well as being the Son of God, Jesus is described as high priest throughout the book. This is one of the main ways in which he describes him. He's also said to be the mediator of the new covenant, the pioneer, the forerunner, the perfecter, and the shepherd. And the author then explains how the Old Testament scriptures and events all pointed to Jesus. And he then urges them to remain faithful using the old trick of carrot and stick. So they had to look to Jesus and the benefits that he brings them, the carrot, and then also warn them of the fearful judgment for those who turn away. In chapter 10, from verse 19, there's a very good example of how he does this. So I'm going to read that to you. So he starts with the carrot. Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and with full assurance that faith brings, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful, and let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. And then comes the stick. If we deliberately keep on sinning after we have received the knowledge of the truth, no sacrifice for sins is left, but only a fearful expectation of judgment and of raging fire that will consume the enemies of God. Anyone who rejected the law of Moses died without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much more severely do you think someone deserves to be punished who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, who has treated as an unholy thing the blood of the covenant that sanctified them, and who has insulted the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, "It is mine to avenge, I will repay." And again, "The Lord will judge his people." It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Do you get that idea? Encouragement, warning. All the way through, you'll find these. Now, apart from the fast-moving thoughts in Hebrews, as I've already said, it's very difficult for us to understand it because of the references to the Old Testament, and I'm going to look into how these are used in a minute. One of the reasons it's complicated is because he was very influenced by the way that the Old Testament was being used in contemporary Jewish teachings and by Jewish eschatology. And probably, as I said, to an extent by philosophy. It really is very important for our understanding of the book that we understand that the author considered the Jewish scriptures to be important. He nowhere rubbishes them. He's not saying we're throwing out all of that and we've now got something completely new. His view was much the same as Jesus's, who I'm sure you remember said, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. And that's really important as we read this. The way in which the author uses the Old Testament to structure most of his arguments about Jesus' superiority to the events that we find in the Old Testament, and particularly through the wilderness wanderings of Moses and that first generation who escaped from slavery in Egypt, that's the main bit of what he's teaching from. So he's looking back to those events all the time as he uses the Old Testament. And he uses these to prove that Jesus is superior and to prove that these always pointed to Jesus by quoting from mainly the Psalms and the prophets. Now, as I said, the way he uses the Old Testament is similar to the way that other Jews of the day were using it. And some of these ways are this. One is that Jews often argued from lesser to greater. So something that was not so good, and then you move it and think of something better. So you get the phrase, how much more, every so often through the book. Also, he brings together different passages that use the same word or words. So, for example, he has a whole string of quotations that have son in it, because he's talking about Jesus as Son of God, and also about rest. And then also stringing together a number of quotes to make a point more forcibly. And another of his tricks is to argue from the silence of Scripture. So there's this figure called Melchizedek, who I'll look at in a bit. And he talks about his genealogy. He says he had no father or mother. Now, we're not told that from Genesis. It wasn't relevant to what the person writing Genesis was writing. But he goes, well, it doesn't mention his father or mother, therefore he didn't have a father and mother. And then the roll call of the faithful in chapter 11, very famous chapter, is very similar to other Jewish lists of the time. But there is a massive difference between the way in which he uses it and the way that other Jews were using it. And that is because he's using it to prove the superiority of Jesus. Everything he writes, every Old Testament passage he quotes, is to show that Jesus is the great high priest who has provided purification for sins and is sitting down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven, so enabling God's people to enter the promised rest, which will ultimately be enjoyed in the heavenly Jerusalem. For the author of Hebrews, the Old Testament doesn't just point to Jesus or just speak of Jesus. It doesn't make any sense without him. As the exalted Son, he is the one that fulfills everything that God said in the Old Testament. Jesus stands in complete continuity with the Old Testament as he fulfills all the previous revelations that were found there. And then there's the influence of Jewish eschatology. In Jewish thought, there was a very strong belief that there were two ages, the present age and the age to come. And again, we find that throughout the New Testament. Jesus himself spoke of both ages when Peter said, "Oh, we've left everything to follow you." And Jesus answered, "Truly, I tell you, no one has left home or wife or brothers or sisters or parents or children for the sake of the kingdom of God will fail to receive many times as much in this age and in the age to come, eternal life." So there's this two ages. And this is very present in Hebrews. So the author speaks of Jesus already seated at the right hand of God, but still waiting for his enemies to be made his footstool. And that's going to take place on the day, which is sometime in the future. The writer explicitly says that Christ will appear a second time to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. And this future realization of the promises given to God's people is the thing that provides their motivation for persevering now, so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in a little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. So you've got these two ages, but like other Christian writers in this period, they were very aware of the fact that we're living in a bit of a sort of bit between, and we're still living in it. Jesus's coming brought fulfillment of that hope expressed in the Old Testament. But the full reality of that fulfillment is in the future. So he says, they have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. But he also says they're still looking for the city that is to come. In a sense, the future has broken into history in the person and work of Jesus. And the believers, like us, already experience the invisible heavenly realities, which include cleansing of conscience, access to God's presence, and forgiveness. We already experience those, and that's known technically as realized eschatology, because it was talking about the future, but it's now in the present, it's happened. But there is that sense in which they and we wait for that fullness, for the visible reality in the age that is to come, which is known as future eschatology, unsurprisingly. And this is why, for the author, faith is so important, because faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. And that's why he spends a whole chapter reminding the readers of the faithful who have come before them, who had to live their lives trusting in promises that they hoped would be fulfilled. And they're told that their longed-for homeland of the city that is to come will be revealed when not only the earth but also the heavens are shaken. And I think this living in between helps us to understand something of the frustration that I think we all feel at times when we know that our old life has gone, we know we've been forgiven, and yet sometimes we find it very hard to really live in that freedom and that change which we have experienced. It's a lot of information there, and I want to give you a bit of work to do now. I've got some copies that I've printed of chapters 1 and 2, and I want you, either working on your own or in twos and threes, to do a bit of unpicking of the way in which the author is using the Old Testament in there. And I suggest that you look for those things that are on the screen. What the author tells us about Jesus, any evidence of the past, the now, the not yet, so the history, the realized eschatology, the future eschatology, his use of carrot and stick, the central importance of the story of Moses and the wilderness wanderings, which I will come back to, the way he uses psalms and prophets to prove his points, the way he argues from lesser to greater, the how much more, the way he groups the quotations according to keywords, and the way he strings quotations together to emphasize a point. So I'm going to give you about 10 minutes, which might not be long enough, but it will be a start. Thanks, Paul, if you could give some of those out. And some pens are here. And as I say, if you want a Bible, there are Bibles. Okay, I'll put you out of your misery. Anybody like to comment on any of those? Anything they've picked out? Anything that excited them? Anything that distressed them? Anything that confused them? I shan't force you. You've been a very good class. Okay, I'll just go through a few bits, and then if anybody wants to pick up on any of those, then they can. So the reason Jesus is compared to the angels in this passage is because traditionally it was the angels that communicated the message from God to Moses on Mount Sinai. That's mentioned in Deuteronomy and again in Acts. And the aim of the author, as I've said before, is to show Jesus' superiority, and in this case, superiority to the angels, to show that whilst they were heavenly messengers, Jesus is divine. And I hope you've seen from that how he does this piling on of quotation after quotation after quotation, one on top of another in a jumble. So we've got several quotations from the Psalms, from Samuel, many of them relating to King David, who of course was the forerunner to the Messiah. So that's why that's important. If you look up some of these quotations, you will find that you don't find them. So for example, where he does the quote, "Let all God's angels worship him," that's actually a quotation from the Septuagint, which doesn't appear in our Bibles because our Bibles are these days translated from the Hebrew, not from the Greek. So, you know, it's like a sermon where you're basing something on a word which you later find actually wasn't in the original, which is a bit embarrassing usually. But yeah, loads of Psalms. Psalm 104 is a very important Psalm, 110, 102. Yeah, loads and loads going on there. And you get the carrot and stick. Did you see the carrot and stick in there? Stick and carrot. Yeah, it doesn't matter which order, he will give you both every time. And after everything he says, he comes up again with this carrot and stick thing. Isn't Jesus great? Beware, don't fall away. All the time. So what's important here is that this message has now been communicated through the Son of God, not through the angels, through the real McCoy rather than just the messengers. Anybody want to say anything else or ask anything else about that? I really did that just so you got a bit of a flavour for yourselves of what this is like and, you know, how tricky and dense it is in places to keep picking out the different things. Happy for me to move on and frazzle your brains a bit more. Okay. So the philosophy side of things. As I say, there's a lot of argument about whether or not the author was very influenced by Greek philosophy or not. I spoke to my brother-in-law, who is an expert on Greek philosophy, and he poo-pooed the idea, as a number of other people have. Why we think, some people think there is an idea going around that he was influenced, is because he uses this language of shadow and copy and pattern. So not only is Jesus superior to the angels and all the others, but there are shadows, there are copies, there are patterns which Jesus or heaven or various other things fulfilled. So, for example, when he compares the tabernacle in the wilderness, he talks about the true tabernacle where Jesus now serves in heaven. And also from the Old Testament law, he says the law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. Am I buzzing? Or is it all right? Yes, no. Okay. So, Plato, who lived 500 years earlier, this is the one that my brother-in-law says he's not influenced by him at all. But anyway, he spoke, or it's thought he spoke, depending who's listened to, about somewhere there being this real world of which this is only a shadowy and imperfect copy. Even if Plato didn't say it, that became the overriding philosophy from that time in Greek ideas. And Philo, who I've mentioned already, was very influenced by the ideas of Plato. So he said things like this: when he, that's God, prepared to create this visible world, he shaped beforehand the ideal world in order to constitute the corporeal after the incorporeal and godlike pattern. So this idea, there's somewhere this ideal world, and this is just a shadow or a copy of that. However, many people feel that there are more dissimilarities than similarities between what Philo was saying and this Greek, whole Greek idea, than anything else. And the suggestion is that rather than the author using philosophy, he was using something else, which is called typology. Now, typology is in lots of different disciplines, but in theology, it's quite specific. It connects events in the past history of Israel, as recorded in the Old Testament, with events in the present and or the future. So something that went on in the Old Testament, in the history of Israel, is seen as a pattern of the way in which God acts and as a prefiguring of the future, which will one day be revealed in the age to come. So Aaron is the high priestly type of which Jesus is the fulfillment. The earthly Sinai is a type of the heavenly Zion to which the readers of Hebrews will come. The old covenant is a type of the new covenant. The promised land is a type of the rest which believers can still look forward to. The old sacrifices are a type of the perfect sacrifice of Christ. And as I say, it's used in a very specific way. We talk about a type of flower. That's not the idea here. It's very much the foreshadowing of something greater. And it's Jesus that fulfills each of these types. So he fulfills the tabernacle, as I've said, the Old Covenant, the Old Testament priests, the sacrifices, Sinai, and this idea of rest. The types provide the pattern and vocabulary for understanding Jesus and the salvation he brings. They help us to understand what the reality is that he has brought. And these are much more than the shadows of Platonic philosophy. They were real events. They weren't just dreams or visions or anything else. They were real events through which God and his ancient people drew near to each other. But ultimately, each of those types were ineffective, and so their true value is in pointing to Jesus. An analogy, which, like all analogies, can only be taken so far, is this that I came up with, I think, in the middle of the night, as you do. So you could say that the shadows of Platonic philosophy are a bit like a drawing of a box of orange juice. It isn't real. You don't get a drink from it. But it points to a reality that exists somewhere. The Old Testament type is a bit like the cheap orange juice that I buy in Tesco. It is real. It does contain oranges, and I can enjoy it, but there is something so much better. And I know, because I've experienced it on the streets of Tel Aviv, that's the freshly squeezed orange juice from Jaffa Oranges a couple of miles down the road. that's the reality. So I don't know if that helps, but that was the best I came up with in the middle of the night. So that's the background that you have to have an understanding of if you're really going to understand the book of Hebrews. As I say, it is complicated, and if you've got any questions on that bit, do ask, or particularly ask David afterwards. Yeah. No, I think in Hebrews it's, I would say in a sense that some of that would be fulfillment of prophecies that Jesus has given about what will happen in the world as the future comes about. Some of it I think we do need to look into and to say, what is God saying through this? And I think we can take messages. But the foreshadowing in Hebrews is very specific in that it's the events from the Old Testament which Jesus then is said to be fulfilling. Does that help? Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to go on to the message of the book of Hebrews. Now, as I said, we can't look at everything in here, so I will, it's a sort of bit of an overview, and then I will pick out a few bits and pieces. So as we've seen, while Hebrews uses many Old Testament passages to point to make the points that the author wants to make, he predominantly is using this history of the wilderness wanderings under Moses to introduce this superior message that Jesus brings as Son of God. Now, obviously, the history of Israel can be traced back much further than the wilderness wanderings, but in a sense, this was the time when the nation was really formed into a coherent whole. So under Moses, they received the law on Mount Sinai, where they entered into a covenant with God based on those laws. And they were also given the plans for, and they built, the tabernacle, which may look like that, who knows, as a place to worship and to sacrifice to God. And there the system of priests was introduced, who were obviously responsible for those sacrifices. The sacrifices were considered to be necessary because once God's laws are broken, there's a barrier between humans and God. And therefore you can't draw near to God. That was very clear from the teachings in the Old Testament. So the idea of the sacrifices by the priests in the tabernacle was to enable that barrier to be lifted, and so the way to God was reopened. But their history clearly showed that it was a very inadequate way for truly bringing them near to God and for enabling them to live according to God's standards, to really be the covenant people that God was calling them to be. And when they left Egypt, they were headed for the promised land. This was the land promised to Abraham and his descendants, to Jacob, to Joseph, who was so convinced that they were going to go there that he asked for his bones to be taken with them, which always seems a bit grisly to me. And they were promised that it was a land flowing with milk and honey. But the generation that left Egypt were so disobedient, and they tested God so frequently that God declared to Moses, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their ancestors. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. And in relation to that, the writer of Hebrews quotes from Psalm 95, "For 40 years I was angry with that generation. I said, they are a people whose hearts go astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest." And it's this story that the author of Hebrews uses as the basis for his explanation of what Jesus has done. Just as God's people who left Egypt were pilgrims, so the readers of Hebrews continue to be pilgrims as they journey on the city that is to come. And we too are pilgrims doing the same. Sorry. There we go. The Psalms and the Prophets, in particular, were used as a way of pointing forward to a time when God would do a new thing, because the people knew that the old system, as I said, was inadequate. That was clearly evident to them. And so there was this time when God would bring a new covenant. Jeremiah 31 talks very clearly about the new covenant, very famous passage. And the writer of Hebrews proclaims that this fulfillment, as we've already said, has now come in the person and work of Jesus. So, for his readers, or for us, to abandon Jesus and turn back to their old ways, turn back to the types rather than to fulfillment, to drinking cheap Tesco orange juice in Thornbury when you could be drinking freshly squeezed Jaffa orange juice in Tel Aviv, is madness. And actually, it's more than madness because of the Old Testament teaching of punishment. They were punished for their unfaithfulness to God. How much more, says the writer, will those who turn from following Jesus, the fulfillment, be punished? While the coming of Jesus does bring a new start, the author sees it as part of the history, the continuing history of the faithful people of God. It's not something completely new. It's not like after the flood, when God sort of said, I've had enough, screw it all up and throw it in the bin and start again. This is a continuity. While Jesus did do a new thing, it wasn't entirely new, because it was all part of God's plan. The Old Testament was always pointing towards what Jesus was going to do. The fundamental belief of both the Old Testament and the writer to the Hebrews is that people, that's you and me, are sinful, that we need mediation to enable us to enter into the presence of God and into a relationship with God. And so, as I've said, the writer is setting out to show just how inadequate that Old Testament system of sacrifices and priests and worship in the tabernacle was. It didn't help them to keep their side of the covenant. And so he wants to prove the necessity of the coming of Jesus. Now, as I say, I haven't got time to go through all the themes in Hebrews. But if you want to do some study in Hebrews, I suggest that you have a think, just reading through and picking out these different themes as they come up. So I would suggest you can, I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can do it, but I would suggest have a look at what his view is of Jesus. We've already seen that in chapters 1 and 2, but follow it through, all the different things he says about Jesus, particularly how Jesus is the great high priest. Look at the covenant, how the new covenant is so much better than the old covenant. Look at the tabernacle, the sacrifices, how Jesus' sacrifice is so much greater than the Old Testament ones. To look at the idea of rest, to look at Sinai as compared to Zion, the heavenly city. To look at the importance of faith, which, whilst chapter 11 is the clear favourite in that, it comes out time and time again. And then again at the warnings, the carrots and the sticks. As I say, I've got a couple of handouts here, which you're free to take afterwards. One of them is a nice simple drawing. So for those of you who like simple drawings, and this is produced by the Bible Project. If you go on their website, you'll see how they reckon that the book is structured, and that is quite helpful. It sets out, you know, the main areas. The other one is from this very short commentary on Hebrews. I read the introduction. And he sets out lots and lots of information here, but I thought this was quite helpful because he gives you lots of verses of... He's quite creative in the way he does it, but it's quite good. So again, if you're interested in trying to pull the book of Hebrews to pieces, do. And if you want to borrow my commentary, I'll put my name in it first, but then you may borrow it. Okay. So I'm going to pick out just a couple of those to look at now. And I want to start by just looking very briefly at the view of Jesus. Now, we've already seen these titles that the author gives to Jesus: Son of God, High Priest, Mediator of a New Covenant, Pioneer, Forerunner, Perfecter, Shepherd. And it is important to note that the author has a very high view of Jesus, both as the Jesus of history, who walked on the earth, and as the eternal Son of God, now risen and glorified. So we've already seen in chapter 1 that Jesus reflects God's glory, that he's the exact image of God, that he's the creator and sustainer of the universe, that he's God's ultimate messenger, and that he's divine because he receives worship from angels, and words about God written in the Old Testament are then attributed to him. I've also said how important the idea is of Jesus as the great high priest, the exalted great high priest, seated at God's right hand, living forever, continuing his priestly work of intercession. That's just a little taste of some of the things he tells us about the divine Jesus. And in terms of Jesus' earthly life, the author speaks of Jesus sharing in humanity, of being fully human in every way. He says that when Christ came into the world, he faced temptation. And regarding Jesus' death, Hebrews speaks of the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ and the blood of Jesus. He says that Jesus endured the cross, scorning its shame for the joy set before him, and that he suffered outside the city gate. These references to Jesus' earthly life are really important because they show that the author did not share the philosophical idea that earthly life was unreal, that it was just shadows, even though he does use that language of shadows and copies. Jesus' earthly life was real and was a vital part of his fulfillment. And also, the Old Testament institution, religious institutions, the events in the Old Testament were also real. Although they are the types, they are not just shadows. They were real events. Jesus' death was an actual event in history which had an effect in the spiritual world. It opened up the way into the presence of God. That Jesus was so clearly both God and man meant that he could be both the perfect priest, taking humans to God and God to humans, and because he was sinless, even in his humanity, he could be the perfect sacrifice, so no further sacrifice is needed. It even breaks the power of death. So you've got these two sides of Jesus, which is worth looking at, vitally important, both sides, God and man, perfect sacrifice, perfect high priest. There's lots more. that you can find out as you read it through. As for Jesus as high priest, as I said, it's probably the most important of the types that we mention, Aaron was the type of which Jesus fulfilled. It runs throughout the book. Every chapter almost, I think, has a mention of it. So that's important that it's Aaron who is the type of Jesus. But I've already mentioned this person, Melchizedek. And the book of Hebrews says that Jesus was not a priest of the order of Aaron. He was not a Levitical priest. He was a priest of the order of Melchizedek. And this again shows a bit of the strange way in which this author uses the Old Testament. So, what have I done now? Oh, there we go. I did order a proper clicky, but it didn't come in time. I was really cross. It promised it would. So he's mentioned in Genesis chapter 14. And what we know about him from there in just those three verses is that he appeared to and blessed Abraham after Abraham had fought a bunch of kings. There he is called the priest of Salem, later Jerusalem, and priest of God Most High. He brought bread and wine, and Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. The only other place that Melchizedek appears in the Old Testament is in Psalm 110, verse 4, where the promise is made to David, and therefore to the Messiah, you are a priest forever of the order of Melchizedek. And that's what the author is picking up on here. So why Melchizedek? Why go into this complication? As I say, this shows again this strange way in which, for us strange, not to Jews, but to us, a strange way that the author uses the Old Testament. He knew that Jesus couldn't be a high priest according to the Old Testament laws because all priests came from the family of Levi, and Jesus came from the tribe of Judah. The author admits that in chapter 7. So, he uses Melchizedek to argue that there was an earlier priesthood in Israel. And in Jewish thought, earlier is better. I've already said that because they nothing is known about him, the author uses that silence, another Jewish trait, that he had no parents and that he lived forever. Neither of which are stated, but he's decided that, because it doesn't say he didn't, he did. And in the author's mind, it's really telling that Abraham gave Melchizedek a tenth of everything he had. Because the Jewish law said that all Israelites had to give priests a tenth. But Abraham gave it to Melchizedek. And Abraham was the father of Levi. So actually, Abraham was the ancestor of all the priests. But Abraham gave it to Melchizedek. So in a sense, all priests gave Melchizedek a tenth, since Levi was still in the body of his ancestor. Okay, I don't think you get away with arguing like this in most ways, but this is the argument that goes on. And it's also important in his mind that Melchizedek blessed Abraham because the lesser is blessed by the greater, and so Melchizedek is put above Abraham. And therefore, above the Old Testament Levitical priests who were still in the body of their ancestor. As I say, this is a very strange argument to us, but it would have made perfect sense to the Jewish audience. And the author uses this to give him the justification for arguing that perfection can't be attained, could never be attained through the Levitical priests, because it was clear from Psalm 110, verse 4, that the Messiah would come as a priest of the superior order of Melchizedek. Is that as clear as mud? Yeah. No. But that's why we're looking at this book, because it is that complicated. It is that weird in places. I want to just look at the idea of rest as well, very briefly. So this comes mainly in chapters 3 and 4. And it again is another, I think, fairly tortuous use of the Old Testament to explain that the readers have still got an opportunity to enter God's rest. So, as I said before, the generation that left Egypt were disobedient, and so all the hope of entering the promised land was lost. And Psalm 95 describes the promised land as the rest. So they missed out on their rest. The author says that since that idea of rest is mentioned in Psalm 95, which was obviously written a long time after the events of the wilderness wanderings, many, many generations after other generations had entered the promised land, written itself probably in the promised land, but it talks about the people would never enter God's rest. So he says, the promise of entering his rest still stands. And he ties up this idea of rest with God resting on the seventh day. So this again is an example of the way he picks up on a word and he uses different ideas from different parts of the Old Testament to draw it all together. And then he returns to the idea that the wilderness generation didn't enjoy the rest, and that earlier in Psalm 95 that talks about this rest, the author of the psalm talks about another today when people can enter that rest, which will be a Sabbath rest, resting from work, just as God did. The promise of rest isn't nullified by the disobedience of the wilderness generation to the author of Hebrews. But he also doesn't think that it's been fulfilled just because their children and grandchildren did enter the promised land. Because, as I said, otherwise there'd be no reason for David mentioning it again later in Psalm 95. So, that rest is still open, and it's a future rest. So the readers are encouraged to make every effort to enter this rest. The old order couldn't fulfill this. The new order in Jesus could. It's very brief, lots more about the rest in there, but this idea it couldn't be fulfilled and that there is now an opportunity to do so. Again, briefly, loads and loads about sacrifices throughout the book. And because the sacrifices were offered in the tabernacle, it's all tied in together. And one of the most important contrasts that the author makes between Jesus and the high priest in Aaron's line is that they had to continually offer sacrifices for themselves as well as for the people, which proved how ineffective it was and how ineffective they were. Now, most of these sacrifices were offered in the tabernacle. And if you've ever looked at the structure of the tabernacle, it made a very clear difference between the holy God and the sinful people. The people themselves weren't able in the tabernacle to draw near to God. They had to go through the priests, and the priests couldn't enter God's presence in the most holy place. Only the high priest could do that, and only once a year, and only after he'd done lots of elaborate purifying of himself with lots of blood sprinkled everywhere, and he had to put on special garments and all the rest. The continual offering of the sacrifices year after year was necessary, the author says, because the law was only a type and not the reality. And so it was unable to make perfect those who draw near to worship. Sacrifices can never take away sins. It was really important for him. On the other hand, Jesus' sacrifice makes people holy and perfect, sanctified. That means dedicated to God. And the author uses Psalm 40, verses 6 to 8, to make the point, which is made several times in the Old Testament, that sacrifices weren't really what God wanted. What he really wanted was obedient people. Even though the law did say there had to be sacrifices. So Jesus' sacrifice, the sacrifice of himself, offered just the once and for everyone, is effective because it enables the fulfillment of the promise of the new covenant, where the laws will be written on people's hearts and sins will be remembered no more. This one's going to be effective. This one is going to deal with sins. And not only that, but it enables all believers, not just the high priest once a year on the Day of Atonement, but whenever, to enter God's very presence, to enter the most holy place, which is now in heaven, the heavenly tabernacle, and to do so with a sincere heart and a cleansed everything. Because, in a sense, the heavenly tabernacle is present on earth and is an effective reality, even though we can't see it. The earthly tabernacle was a copy and a shadow of the true one. Jesus enters heaven once for all by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption to appear for us in God's presence. That's the reality. That's the one that he's most concerned about. I'm aware of the time, so I'm not going to... I was going to look at faith briefly, but I'm not going to do that. As I say, you know, use any commentary you've got, but mainly use the book. Pull out these themes. Pull out all that it has to say. It is a book which you could spend months on, especially if you borrow my commentary. And but do it, because it is so full of such amazing things about Jesus. So I want to just finish, not with that one. Come on, move on. But with this. These are the words at the end, near the end of chapter 13. Now may the God of peace, who through the blood of the eternal covenant brought back from the dead our Lord Jesus, that great shepherd of the sheep, equip you, equip us with everything good for doing his will. And may he work in us what is pleasing to him, through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen.